True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
In September 2015, 25-year-old Jack Taylor was found dead. He was in the graveyard of St. Margaret's Church in East London. Jack wasn't the first young man to be found dead under these unexplained circumstances, all within a few hundred yards of one another. It was initially believed that these deaths resulted from drug overdoses, but Jack's death led the police to find a more sinister cause. A killer had actually lured these men to their deaths using online dating apps. 2 days before Jack Taylor was found dead, he had arranged to meet with a man he'd been chatting with on the dating app Grindr. When his family and friends didn't hear from Jack, they reported him missing. Then the police showed up at his parents' home with the worst news imaginable. Join us at the quiet end for The Grindr Killer. 4 suspicious deaths under very similar circumstances in the same area of London all pointed to one killer. Today we're going back 40 years to learn about the monster responsible and his methods to lure young gay men into his deadly web of lies.
So today's beer is Old Engine Oil. And I'm kind of fudging a little bit because this is a beer brewed in Scotland.
Well, that's a big fudging.
I know. But I like the beer, so I wanted to use it.
Okay, and I'll allow it.
We still are in the United Kingdom, so.
Sure.
A little tenuous there. Anyway, Old Engine Oil looks like Old Engine Oil. It's an opaque black beer. It's got a pretty thick, somewhat sticky tan head. There's a nice aroma of some chocolate and fruit. Then you get a very good taste, espresso, dark chocolate, maybe a hint of cherry. This is just a wonderful beer, easy drinking, only 6% alcohol by volume, so you're not going to fall off your bar stool after you drink a few.
Sure.
Let's have some.
Okay, well, it's a weird name, but it sounds delicious, so I'll try some. Okay. Let's open it up.
I think you'll like it.
All right, over here at the quiet end. Come on over.
Okay, I see. Yeah, there's still plenty of seats here, aren't there?
Yeah, it's still early.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why don't you start us off? This is really kind of a disturbing case that I backed away from for a while because it's uncomfortable. But I think the point with this case is really just the botched police investigation, which really got to me.
I think that's the major point on this case.
Yeah, because mistakes were made, but a lot of them were made just by complete negligence to look into things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not, at least from what I know, it's not that hard a case to solve.
No, and the other thing is, if the first one or two had been solved, you would have been able to save some people.
Maybe you'd save a couple. That's
yes,
right.
Exactly.
So let's get started. Stephen John Port, that's our guy. He was born in Southend-on-Sea, Britain. February 22nd, 1975. When he was just a one-year-old, his parents moved the family to Dagenham. Stephen grew up to be a bit of a loner. In school, he was a pretty withdrawn kid, and he just seemed to have trouble getting along with the other students. He was a pretty quiet and serious kid. He seemed more like an adult than like the other children. In fact, he was so quiet around the other kids that some of the kids thought he was hearing impaired. Now, that's pretty quiet.
Yeah, he just didn't engage.
Nope.
No.
Stephen's parents, Joan and Albert Port, had 2 children. His sister Sharon was 2 years older than Stephen. Now, at age 16, Stephen went to art college. But due to his parents' financial limitations, he needed to change course. So he ended up training as a chef. I guess that means that they had not enough money to go to art school, but he could go to chef school.
That's the way I would take it, yes.
So having this artistic talent, but being unable to afford art school, did cause some resentment in Stephen. It left him with the feeling that he could have made much more out of his life, but he'd been held back. He ended up working at a bus depot, cooking for the drivers and the other staff.
So back when Stephen came out to his family as gay, his parents weren't comfortable with his lifestyle. That's the way they looked at it. And his father blamed his son's shyness for his homosexuality, even suggesting that someone had taken advantage of him when he was little and turned him gay. So that's where Stephen was coming from. So some dysfunction.
Just a bit.
But not that unusual back in the day, I would imagine.
Oh, no, it wasn't.
So in his late 20s, Stephen got his own apartment in Barking, which was kind of the dodgy end of London, right?
Sure.
And he made new friends in the gay community. But those friends began to notice some things off about him. He cheated on each one of his romantic partners, for one thing.
That's a big thing.
Yes. And he eventually turned to earning money as a male escort. And then he became a pimp for other escorts. And he also began using drugs more and more. His drug of choice became GHB, which is a party drug that initially acts like a stimulant, but is in fact a depressant. It produces feelings of euphoria and relaxation, but if enough of it is taken, the user becomes unconscious, which is why it's also been used as a date rape drug.
Yeah, it works quite well for that. Unconscious and then amnesia, usually following the event.
Right, exactly. Stephen's mom, Joan, was closer to Stephen than his dad was, and she would visit him at his apartment. She said Stephen was very neat and tidy, always kept his apartment clean. According to Sharon, her brother had a boyfriend of sorts who was paying his household bills and expenses for him for a time, but she never met this guy. So also, Stephen became known for lying about his background. He claimed to have been in the Royal Navy, to have graduated from Oxford, and to have worked as a special education teacher. And then, in his role as a chef, he claimed to help disabled students learn to cook. And Stephen had a lot of this misinformation posted on his Facebook page. So that's why we can read that and back that up.
Yeah, I sure can. Now, there was a young gay man named Ryan Edwards who lived in the same neighborhood as Stephen. And he introduced himself to Stephen in 2005. Now, to Ryan, Stephen was a tall, quiet type of guy who didn't talk a lot, nor did he make a lot of eye contact. He just seemed pretty socially awkward.
Well, like I said, as a child, Stephen seemed serious and adult-like, but then as a grown man, he had a real childlike quality. Ryan started to see Stephen as this different sort of guy, kind of immature and definitely socially inept. For one thing, Stephen collected and played with children's toys. And at a party at Ryan's house, Ryan gave Stephen a toy fire truck that he had found. But he didn't just display these toys, he actually sat on the floor in the middle of the party and played with the truck, making little noises and stuff. So that was bizarre. According to Ryan, Stephen seemed to be in his own world, and he showed no concerns over what the other people at the party might be thinking about this. So because he was so socially awkward, Stephen was very attracted to social media and dating apps. He wasn't comfortable going out to the pubs or bars at night to meet men, but online it was easy. He could portray the image he wanted others to see. He actually put a lot of effort into what he wrote in his online profiles and the pictures of himself that he shared. And he created multiple profiles on several sites and apps. So this allowed him to have a variety of identities, and it was not unusual for him to be with a different guy every day. The dating apps were great in his view because he could present himself as younger and as more attractive than he actually was. And that way he could attract the younger guys that he was attracted to. He was really comfortable in the company of men in their 20s, even when he entered his 40s. And the dates he sought out were these small-statured, delicate-featured men in their 20s. So this gave him the control that he really craved, that he liked to have over his partners.
According to Ryan Edwards, Stephen often left his boyfriends with him, and Ryan got to know them quite well. So these guys would often complain to Ryan that Stephen mentally abused them, manipulated them, and controlled them. Flattering picture of Mr. Port, huh? Although they expressed these problems, many of them still continued to spend time with Port.
They did, and it seemed like he got worse and worse as things progressed. He became physically abusive as well because Ryan saw signs of that. And it seemed to Ryan that Stephen was controlling them in some way to keep them from leaving him. So Ryan kind of backed off his friendship with Stephen Port after seeing large amounts of drugs in his apartment. He saw a big box on Port's kitchen table filled with bags of white powder and vials of liquid. And this was disturbing. This was way more than he could have just had for personal use. So Ryan wondered what he was up to, but kind of decided he didn't want to know.
Yeah, exactly. So then by June of 2014, Port's appetite for young men and drugs led into more drug-fueled sex acts and violence. His desires and his internet searches became more perverse and more dangerous, and he became obsessed with finding young men.
And he was able to find quite a few of them.
Well, yeah. He never didn't have any trouble.
No, but if you looked at him, really not an attractive guy, especially when he got a little older. He was bald, his eyes were kind of off, he just wasn't very attractive. But he was able to portray himself on the dating apps using younger pictures and filters and things. And then once he got these people in his clutches, there was some way that he did control them. So on June 15th, 2014, Port connected online with 23-year-old Anthony Patrick Walgate. Anthony was a second-year fashion and art student at the University of Middlesex. When he moved from Hull to attend the university, it was difficult for him to pay his bills. So Anthony had run an ad on the Sleepy Boys app to get jobs as a male escort, and being an escort gave him enough money to support himself while he worked on his education.
Then on June 15th, 2014, Stephen Port contacted Anthony on Sleepy Boys, and he offered him £800 if he would come over to Stephen's home overnight for sex. So after Anthony set up the appointment and got the location from Port, he told a friend of his about the date and where he would be, and he even shared the fake name Port had given him, which was Jodine. So he gave this information to the friend, saying, "Just in case I get killed." Huh, he didn't know he was being prophetic.
No. Right after Port made this date with Anthony, he went online and typed in the search, "drug rape pornography." Then 2 days later, he went to the Barking Rail Station at 10 p.m. to meet Anthony and bring him back to his apartment. 2 days later, on June 19th, the police received a phone call about a dead body that was found in front of a nearby apartment building on Cook Street, right near Stephen Port's apartment building. So it was Stephen himself who made this anonymous call to 911 that morning. And it's interesting because he hangs up a couple times. He's trying to act like he just drove by and saw this body sitting there right outside of his apartment. So let's play the 999 call.
Emergency ambulance. What's the address of the emergency?
Miss Cook. Cook Street. There's a young boy. Look like he's trapped outside. I don't know.
Outside of which number?
4758.
Sorry?
4758, I think.
47 Cook Street.
Yeah.
What area?
Barking. It looks like he's collapsed or had a seizure or something. He's just always just drunk. But,
okay. What's the telephone number you're calling from?
I'm just pulling up in the car. I've got to get my car down the parking.
Oops. All right, don't worry about that. What's the telephone number you're calling from? Hello? The ambulance service. Well, the car's over there. Just confirm the location.
Oh, I'm just doing it right now.
Where was it that they were outside of?
Cook Street.
What door number?
I don't know, I didn't look.
You said 47 before.
Yeah, so that's 47. Yeah.
You think that they had a seizure, is that correct?
It's on the floor. Yeah.
Were you passing by in your car?
Yes.
Okay, and you've drove past now, so you're no longer there.
That's right.
How old did he look, roughly, sir?
20.
Do you know if he was awake?
No.
Do you know if he was breathing?
No, I don't know.
Did you see anything happen at all?
No.
No, you just think they possibly had a piece where he was lying there on the floor?
Yes.
Thanks for letting us know. We'll get someone there as soon as we can.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello, sir. It's the ambulance service. Sorry to bother you again. It was definitely Cook Street that the patient was on.
Yes, definitely. Yes, yeah. It was Cook Street.
Okay. And were you just kind of driving past and you just kind of saw the patient lying there?
I was just driving in my car park.
Oh, into your car park there?
So, the 994.
Okay.
I got out, had a look at him.
Yeah.
Called you, but got back in the car.
No worries. Just wanted to be sure. We've got someone there anyway. Thank you for your help. I'm sorry to bother you again.
Okay, no worries.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so he hung up on them twice. And another thing I thought was noteworthy is how he gave them the building number. And then the second time they called him back, he said he didn't know.
Yeah.
They had
to remind him that you told us this before.
Right. So I kind of felt like the operator was very suspicious of him.
Mm-hmm.
But it really wasn't followed up on, at least not to the point it should have been.
No.
So when the police showed up at that scene, they found Anthony Walgate's body propped up against Port's apartment building wall. His shirt had been pulled up around his chest and his pants zipper was undone. His head was hanging forward as if he was asleep, and Anthony's underwear had been removed and put back on inside out and backwards. He also had 14 bruises on his body, and it would turn out he died of an overdose of GHB. There was also a bottle of GHB found in Anthony's pocket. So after a brief inquiry, Anthony's death was ruled a drug overdose, not a sex crime or a homicide, despite some of that evidence, which suggests that.
Yeah, well, yeah. The guy who made the call, that'd be someone you'd want to talk to, right?
Sure.
And it seems like, you know, they found the GHB in his pocket and they learned on autopsy that he'd had an overdose, so that was enough investigating for them.
Exactly, right. And they would look into Stephen Port a bit as the caller, but they didn't really investigate him as maybe being responsible for this young man's death. So very poor investigation.
Yeah, not much at all.
Yeah, so this death from GHB, that's what killed all four of Stephen Port's victims, which we'll get into the rest of them. But I thought before we get into that, maybe you could explain a little bit about GHB, the mechanism of action, and why that would be a drug that Stephen Port would use.
Well, sure. I'll try anyway. So GHB is a metabolite of the neurotransmitter GABA, G-A-B-A. That's gamma-aminobutyric acid. Now, GABA is the most prevalent inhibitory neurotransmitter that's in the central nervous system. Inhibitory neurotransmitters have many functions, but mostly they serve to modulate the central nervous system by slowing down the firing of other neurons, both in the brain and spinal cord. So that's why they call it an inhibitory neurotransmitter. It basically slows things down. It had been used as an anesthetic at one time, but that using it as that resulted in a number of serious side effects. So this has been discontinued, at least for use as an anesthetic agent. GHB did become a popular drug in the 80s because it was used to improve athletic performance and reduce body fat. So its popularity, it was popular with bodybuilders, and this popularity continues. Although the drug is not an anabolic steroid, even though it's often portrayed as one. And then it also has a reputation as an aphrodisiac, and it is one of the major date rape drug of those drugs used by sexual predators. GHB's use was banned by the DEA in 2000, but a couple years later it was found to be useful in treating narcolepsy, which is the disorder where you just conk out, you fall asleep.
Yeah, so I find that strange. If it can make you unconscious, but it can be used to keep you conscious. It's weird.
Yeah. So because it was found to be useful in narcolepsy, it was given special permission by the FDA to be used specifically for that purpose. And it can be produced artificially by using some very common ingredients. So anybody, you don't even need a chemistry degree. It's a fairly simple drug to make.
He had a lot of it.
Yeah. Yeah, whoever found that stash, I mean, that was not just for personal use. He was selling it.
You think he was selling it? Okay.
Or
I thought maybe he was just using it on these young men, but selling it's also a possibility.
Well, the amount, and I don't know, the the BBC special or documentary that we watched.
Yes.
There was a ton.
Yeah, there was a lot.
Maybe that was for television, but there was a lot of GHB.
Yeah, it did really show it as being a lot. So its abuse does still occur in three major groups of people. It's used as a rave or a club drug, and it still has a reputation with younger people as being a safer alternative to ecstasy. So it produces feelings of euphoria and sociability, and it's still considered to be an aphrodisiac, although there's no proof of that. Predators still use GHB as the date rape drug, like you mentioned, because it can produce unconsciousness and memory loss when given to people who take it unsuspectingly. Athletes and bodybuilders do still use GHB as a fat-burning aid and to increase energy and their athletic performance, but its ability to increase muscle mass as an aphrodisiac and as an athletic performance enhancer are just mostly not true. It doesn't really work. Its effect on memory and consciousness when used as a date rape drug, though, is very valid. It does work for that.
Yeah, but there are some dangers, right?
Absolutely.
Quite real. Now, the first one, the biggest one, even extremely small amounts can be toxic. So the safe range of the drug is pretty small, very small. Then if you use it chronically, it can produce hallucinations, confusion, violent outbursts, and issues with depression. Also can cause seizures. Then using GHB results in large increases in serotonin and dopamine in the central nervous system. And the release of these neurotransmitters accounts for the euphoric effects and the increased sociability that seems to occur in users. But when an individual stops using a drug, the levels of these neurotransmitters drop, and that leads to issues with apathy, depression, hopelessness, and lethargy. Small amounts of the drug affect memory while a person is under the influence of the drug, and individuals basically can't recall events that took place while under the drug's influence. So this is the biggest reason sexual predators like using GHB. And then finally, GHB has some effects on the hypothalamus, and that's an organ in the brain involved in maintaining a number of regulatory functions in the body. So one of the consequences of GHB is that the regulatory functions of the hypothalamus regarding body temperature can be disrupted, and you can become overheated very quickly.
So it's really not something you should be messing around with.
Boy, it sure isn't.
And of course, giving it to someone without their consent is a horrible thing to do. So police did investigate the number they received on that 999 call, and they learned that it belonged to Stephen Port. 1 week after Anthony was found dead, officers visited Port and they asked him some questions. And after this cursory investigation, they found out that Port had hired Anthony as a male escort. So they arrested Port for suspicion of perverting the course of justice. In simple terms, he was just charged with lying to the police. This was mostly because he didn't keep his story straight that they even charged him with that. He was very consistent, though, in his claim that Anthony had willingly taken the GHB. And the police just took his word for it. So according to Port, Anthony had wanted to take the drug to get horny and to get high. And he'd shown up with a small brown bottle of the drug himself. He'd said that it wasn't until after he returned from an 8-hour night shift at the bus stop diner that Port found Anthony stiff in his bed where he had left him, supposedly alive and fine. Now, he claimed that he was still alive when he found him, but he was making a gurgling noise. Port said that after he found Anthony, he panicked and dragged him out of his apartment building and left him leaning against the wall. Port claimed to not have checked if Anthony was still alive, so he didn't know. And then he got into his car and drove and decided to make that 999 call. So to me, even if that was the behavior he was responsible for, he probably should have been charged with more than just lying to the police.
Yeah, I just don't like that story, you know?
Well, it's not a true story. We're pretty sure of that. But the fact that the police believed it and didn't do further investigation is concerning. In March 2015, Port was convicted and sentenced to 8 months in jail, and he served just 3 months. He wore an electronic ankle band until June of 2015. Then the case was closed. DNA samples were not even tested. Computers that were found were not examined. If Port's computer hard drive had just been searched, police would have seen several disturbing online searches that he had done right before he contacted Anthony on the Sleepy Boy site. And these searches included date drugs to rape gay boys and unconscious boys rape videos. Several other things in a similar vein as well, which really is concerning. Because even if you didn't believe that he purposely killed this young man, certainly rape was something that should have been considered.
Well, if they delved a little deeper, yeah.
Absolutely.
This, at the same time, this is the first one. I'm more concerned when this happens again and again, that there should have been a better investigation. I can kind of see if this is the first case, maybe they'll figure Port's okay or his story's okay.
Well, maybe, but they should have investigated it in the very least. I see what you're saying, because as there were more people, it should have been more obvious.
It certainly should have been.
But even early on, they should have done a deeper investigation into what actually happened.
Yeah, they could have.
And a lot of people would say if this had been a young woman in a heterosexual relationship, it would have been treated differently. And I do think that's a good possibility. I think there's some homophobia to this, or just not caring. You know, there's the gay aspect. There's also the drug use aspect, where people who are drug addicts or using street drugs are often written off as not being equal to other people. And they also do that, of course, with gay people. So I think that those were two strong factors in this investigation really thoroughly sucking.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that.
And this was just the beginning of the police allowing Stephen Port to get away with murder. You know, no members of the LGBT community in that area were even interviewed. If they had been, there were people, including Ryan Edwards, who had further information that could have helped out.
Yep. And Anthony's aunt, Kate Whelan, was unable to get the police to further investigate Anthony's death. She made an appeal for people to be careful when using dating apps and websites. And she said to the local media, "Aunt was murdered by a predatory serial sex fiend. Age just 23, our aunt was enjoying university and had an exciting future. Our lives will never be the same. We live daily with trauma, shock, anger, and pain. Please be careful if you are using dating apps. Although your kids are young adults and you feel they are sensible, please reinforce the stranger danger warnings. The internet is a fabulous thing. But be aware, there are predators."
So she was right on the money there. Right away, she thought he was murdered.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing police should have listened to, what kind of young man this was and what he would have been involved in and what he might not have been involved in if it was his choice. But before Port was sent to jail for lying to the police, he would commit more crimes. 22-year-old Gabriel Kovary moved to London from Slovakia in June of 2014, and he found a flatmate. But after just 6 weeks living in the spare room of John Pape, Gabriel moved in with Stephen Port. Then in August, Gabriel was living with Port when Ryan Edwards was introduced to him by Port. Port had described Gabriel as his new Slovakian twink flatmate, and Ryan liked Gabriel, who was intelligent and nice to talk to. So Ryan kept in touch with Gabriel. They texted each other occasionally. And when Ryan texted Port to tell him how nice he thought that Gabriel was, Port texted back, "Will do, I'm taking good care of him, he he he."
Then within days of that text, Ryan noticed that Gabriel just wasn't there. He had disappeared. He texted Port asking him if he had heard from Gabriel. And Port replied that he didn't know where he was, that he may have left to stay with some soldier that he liked. Short time later, Ryan received a long text from Port saying that he had some really sad news. According to Port, Gabriel had gone back home, picked up a mysterious illness, and died.
So now, that's hard to swallow.
It is. Port also told Ryan, "Don't mention this. Don't say anything to his friends and family, particularly on Facebook, because they're already really upset. That wouldn't help them."
Right, exactly. But Port had killed Gabriel with an overdose of GHB. Then he'd moved Gabriel's body a few hundred meters away, this time to the graveyard of St. Margaret's Church. So it was August 20th, and East London resident Barbara Denham was out walking her dog on the church grounds, which was her habit to do. She unleashed her dog to let him run around a bit, and as she walked toward the abbey, she noticed a young man sitting upright against the stone wall. Barbara approached him, but when she was close enough to speak to him, she noticed that he was very still, and he didn't seem to be breathing. His head was down, and he was wearing sunglasses, but they were crooked on his face, and she could tell something definitely was not right. She clapped her hands and she shouted out, but he didn't respond. Then she noticed that his skin had a bluish hue and that his eyes were glassed over, so she called 999 right then. When the police came, they suspected that Gabriel had died from a self-inflicted drug overdose, and they decided that his death was not suspicious. They tracked down his address, which led them to the apartment of John Pape. But John had many questions about Gabriel's death. He went online and he found an article about Anthony Walgate's death. Anthony's body had been found in almost identical conditions just 2 blocks from where Gabriel had been found. But the police were not making that connection. They didn't link the deaths of these 2 young gay men at all, and they gave no warnings to the local gay community. Ryan Edwards didn't even hear about the deaths, even though they occurred right in his neighborhood. And he had vital evidence in texts on his phone. But it wasn't shared with the police because he didn't even know it was significant. So I really think if the police had reached out to the LGBT community there, local people would have been aware and they would have shared what they knew to help in the investigation. So definitely lives could have been saved.
Yeah, this is what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe the first time, and now they have 2 deaths in fairly close proximity to each other, right?
Very close.
And similarities in the deaths. So, boy.
Very similar, yeah.
That should be investigated.
Absolutely it should, but it really wasn't. Then, just a week after that, Stephen Port contacted 21-year-old Daniel Whitworth on the gay dating site FitLads. On September 3rd, 2014, Port asked Daniel to meet for a coffee or a drink before having dinner at his apartment. And in his message, Port wrote, "Just so you get to know me a bit, so you know I'm not some psycho."
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Another comment that just makes my blood run cold.
So, 3 weeks after finding Gabriel's body, here's old Barbara walking her dog again on the same church grounds. And she noticed another young man sitting in the exact same place where she had found Gabriel.
Isn't that unbelievable?
So, and she's
looking. The same woman.
Same woman. It is unbelievable. And this body, as people might have guessed, was Daniel Whitworth.
Yes, well, she thought, oh no, please not another one, hoping that this was just a drunk kid. But when she approached him, she knew right away that he was dead. She touched his skin where his ankle was exposed, and he was cold to the touch. So she called 999 again from her cell phone, but she wasn't as calm this time, because she thought there was a pattern. So, you know, even Barbara, right there, not a policewoman, not an investigator, but she made the connection in her mind. She's found 2 dead bodies in similar circumstances. So her voice was really shaky as she called the operator and said she'd found another dead boy. So of course this is suspicious to anyone in their right mind, and Barbara was just not impressed with the police response. So a curious thing about this one is that Daniel had a suicide note found beside him. And the note suggested that he was responsible for the death of Gabriel Covari by overdose on the party drug GHB during a sexual hookup that they had had. So Daniel Whitworth had committed suicide because he couldn't deal with the guilt, was what they would have you believe from this note. So here's the note. "I'm sorry to everyone, mainly my family, but I can't go on anymore. I took the life of my friend Gabriel Klein. We was just having some fun at a mate's place, and I got carried away and gave him another shot of G. I didn't notice while we was having sex that he stopped breathing. I tried everything to get him to breathe again, but it was too late. It was an accident, but I blame myself for what happened, and I didn't tell my family I went out. I know I would go to prison if I go to the police, and I can't do that to my family, and at least this way I can be with Gabriel again, and I hope he will forgive me. By the way, please do not blame the guy I was with last night. We only had sex and then I left. He knows nothing of what I have done. I have taken what G I have left with sleeping pills, so if it does kill me, it's what I deserve. Feeling dizzy now as I took 10 minutes ago, so hoping you will understand my writing. I dropped my phone on my way here, so it should be in the grass somewhere. Sorry to everyone. Love always, Daniel P.W.
Now, what the police did was they didn't show the entire note to Daniel's parents. They just showed, like, the bottom half or something. And they looked at it. The parents looked at it and said, that's not something that Daniel had written. Didn't look like his handwriting. Didn't sound like they knew he would sound. So the police did not take their opinion into account. They ended up telling the parents, well, it is what it is, and you're just going to have to deal with it.
Well, that's really nice.
Yeah, it's a big help.
It really is. And his parents were just so confused because Daniel was a happy guy, no history of drug abuse, and his death just made no sense. Daniel had been raised most of his life by his father, so he was just the apple of his eye. He was everything to him. He was his father's only child and just adored by him. And, of course, his stepmom had grown to love him as well. So this loss was completely overwhelming for the family, but they felt that the police were uninterested in even doing an investigation, which just made it worse. The pathologist who examined Daniel's body did note that there was bruising below both of Daniel's arms, which may have resulted from manual handling of him before he died. Still, the police didn't view his death as suspicious at all. They accepted what was written in the note, but Daniel's parents thought that the police were having the handwriting professionally analyzed. They gave the police samples of Daniel's writing and waited to hear back about that.
Yeah, now later on when his parents were able to see the entire note, they found it was so cold and matter-of-fact that there's nothing telling them it was actually from Daniel. And it also said, don't blame the guy I was with last night.
Which is super suspicious.
Right?
Yeah.
So Daniel's parents wanted to know, who's that guy?
Well, sure, and you think the police would have wanted to know. That's such an obvious way to try and deter someone.
Well, you would think. In fact, they asked that question of the police, and the police said they didn't know, and they might never know.
They didn't really care who it was.
Nope.
But, you know, if they just made that connection to Anthony... They knew that Anthony was with Stephen Port. Stephen Port had been arrested for lying to the police over Anthony's death. So the fact that they didn't look into him right away on this is just mind-boggling. And if they'd done a thorough investigation, they could have quite easily made the connections to solve this case, but they just weren't interested.
They sure didn't seem that way. Now, when Gabriel's ex-flatmate, John Pape, heard about this third death, he was worried that the deaths were all connected. And he became concerned for his own safety.
Well, yeah, he doesn't know who's murdering these gay men in his area.
Right. So he calls up the police, but they assured him, these deaths were not murders. Don't worry.
Yeah, he's actually concerned. He says, this kid was my roommate, and he was found dead. Two other young men were found dead. I'm a gay young man in the same area who knew him. What's going on here? And they just said, these aren't suspicious. These aren't murders. Pretty much just leave us alone. And Stephen Port made attempts to bolster his cover story, too. He made up a fake Facebook profile under the name John Luck. And this was supposedly a 21-year-old former gay porn star from California, now living in England. And he claimed to have known Gabriel. He started spreading stories about Gabriel and Daniel being involved in dangerous chemsex orgies. He said that the two young men had been together at an orgy in the area, and he wrote that it was the young guys being given loads of drugs from older guys, and that the young ones were taken advantage of when they passed out. So there are little bits of truth sprinkled in there.
Yeah, here and there.
He said that one of them passed out and woke up being raped, and he wrote that the parties sometimes lasted for days nonstop. So really, if you're a decent investigator, you would see this all as very suspicious and as a way for him to try and cover things up.
Well, you would.
But if you don't look into it, you'll never know. John Pape went back to the police, and he was told that because he wasn't next of kin, he couldn't get any information. But Pape told the police that he might have information that could help with their investigation. He'd been Gabriel's roommate. He knew different people Gabriel had seen and what Gabriel had done. But they told Pape they would have to speak with their superior officer and get back to him. But they never contacted him again. So they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want any information that he might have.
Yeah, that's right. So Pape contacted gay online news site, P Pink News, and also Gallup, which is an LGBT support group, and they have close connections with the police. Both of the organizations contacted the police to let them know about Pape's concerns. They told the police that Pape could have relevant information about Gabriel and Daniel and chemsex parties. But the police, for whatever reason, said they didn't want to speak to Pape. And furthermore, they said none of these three deaths were suspicious. See, well, yeah, I guess at this point you're getting caught, so you got to double down. Either you admit that you fucked up or you just double down on it.
You're so right. You're so right about that. I definitely see it the same way. So on June 23rd, 2015, Daniel Whitworth's parents were asked to come to the inquest into Daniel's death, and they learned that the police had recorded that they had positively identified Daniel's handwriting in that suicide note. The coroner asked the detective if the handwriting had been analyzed, and the detective said that they had looked at it themselves at the police station. But no expert analysis had even been done. Too expensive.
So it's like you or me looking at some handwriting and say, yeah, that matches.
Yeah, could be him. Yeah. Well, the detective in charge was then asked about a blue bedsheet that Daniel had been found sitting on, and his parents knew nothing about this. No DNA testing had been done on this bedsheet, the detective said, because they didn't think that this death was suspicious. But if that DNA had been tested, they would likely have found Stephen Port's DNA, right? Which, of course, was in the police database already because of his earlier arrest.
So, possibly. But it didn't happen.
No. So, another mistake made.
Yeah, then the coroner brought up the bruising that had been found under Daniel's arms and on his chest. Daniel's parents, looking at this, say, well, that's not a suicide. He'd been taken to that spot and dumped.
It seems obvious, really.
Now, the parents asked for further investigation, but they were told, no more investigation's going to be done. So we've got this open verdict, but no more was going to be done about it. Case closed. Now, Daniel's parents felt that big mistakes had been made, and that the killer of Daniel, Gabriel, and Anthony would never be found. And this cleared the way for another young man to be killed in the same fashion. So let's add one more corpse.
Right. So even if you're doubtful after the first kid, after the second kid, and then after the third kid, come on. This is just such an obvious pattern. I think this Barbara finding two dead boys in the same position in the same place, right there, that should have been plenty to set off a huge investigation.
Right. There are no coincidences here.
No, absolutely. So on September 13th, 2015, Stephen Port exchanged messages with 25-year-old Jack Taylor. Jack lived in Dagenham with his parents and worked as a forklift operator. He had two sisters he was very close with as well. So Jack didn't come home that Saturday night, and on Monday he still wasn't home. The police showed up at Jack's parents' house and informed them that Jack was dead. The police told the family that Jack was found in the St. Margaret's graveyard and that he was dead of a drug overdose. They'd also found a syringe in Jack's pocket and a needle mark in his arm. But his family didn't believe that Jack would willingly take these drugs. He was anti-drug, so he certainly wasn't going to be injecting himself with drugs.
Not likely.
So Jack's sisters were really heroes in this case. They got a lot done because they weren't going to accept this.
They knew in their heart of hearts that the police scenario wasn't the case.
Right. So, and the things they would find out when they started investigating would only back that up and convince them more.
Absolutely. So they contacted the police for an update on Jack's case. It was about 2 weeks into it. They learned that nothing had been done in the investigation since Jack had been found. So, it's according to the police, he'd been found dead of a drug overdose, and that was that. Yeah.
Right.
So, the sisters were just incredulous at this attitude, and they began their own investigation. And it didn't take them long to find out about the other three nearly identical deaths, for sure.
No, all it took was a simple internet search to make this connection, and it's a connection the police were unwilling to make.
It was a real difficult connection to make.
So I feel like if it wasn't for the sisters and John Pape and some others, I think Stephen Port could have gone on killing, because he wasn't even very creative or smart about this.
No, he wasn't.
The first one was right outside of his apartment, and he called 999 himself.
Yeah, and the others were within, what, a couple hundred yards from him in the graveyard?
Yeah, in nearly identical circumstances.
Yeah.
So the sisters continued to question the investigators about a connection between these deaths. Finally, the police showed the sisters some CCTV footage that they had of Jack meeting a man and walking down the street with him. So the sisters hadn't even been aware that this footage existed before that day. And they asked about the man in the footage with Jack, but the police said they didn't know who the man was, and they didn't seem to care. I mean, of course it was Stephen Port, but the police showed no concern and did nothing about it. They didn't even look into who it might have been. It seems there's no evidence they did any investigating. Which, if someone turns up dead, the last person they're seen walking around with at night, that should be an important thing to look into.
Certainly be a person of interest, right?
Right. And there had to be records. He hooked up with these people through social media and apps. All that could easily be traced.
Yes.
But it wasn't. So the police told the sisters that they had Jack with the man up until a certain point. Then they lost the man, and they saw Jack walk ahead alone to the churchyard, where he was later found. And this did not make sense at all to Jack's sisters. Jack would not have walked through the park in the dark, and then sat down in the dirt against a stone wall where he was found. And he wouldn't do drugs, especially injecting drugs. So the sisters were thoroughly convinced that Jack would not have walked alone into this churchyard. So they went back to the spot where the CCTV footage of Jack and the man ended, and they asked police if maybe Jack might have turned left at that spot and not walked toward the churchyard. And they finally got a policeman to go look at that footage again. And this officer looked at the footage and learned that the sisters were totally correct about this. Jack had not walked off on his own at all. He was always with this man in the footage. So Jack's sisters asked the police to release an image of this man from the footage to the public to try and get an identity. And it took several requests, but they finally did do that. The footage was finally shown on TV, and then Stephen Port was arrested.
Yeah, that was easy.
It could have been a lot easier and done a lot sooner.
Couldn't it?
Yes.
So Donna Taylor, who's Jack's mother, said that the police should be held accountable for her son's death. She's accused the police of class, gender, and sexual bias, and suggested that lives may have been saved had the police acted sooner. She's not the only one thinking that way.
No, not at all.
So the case ended up being given over to a specialized homicide unit. Port was brought in and interrogated by the police on October 15, 2015. And he denied involvement in any of the deaths. Now, during his interrogation, Port showed some signs of nervousness, and these signs struck the detectives as maybe some deception going on. So one thing was the very low volume in his voice. Then he crossed his arms and he clenched his fists. And he was also scratching at his nose and squirming in his chair. But I guess out of context, you don't get a real appreciation for that.
No, but when you watch it, you really can see.
Yes.
Yes. So he was charged for the murders of Anthony, Gabriel, Daniel, and Jack, and for drugging and or raping 7 more young men. So the prosecution opened by telling the jury that Stephen Port would meet young men through websites and dating apps such as Grindr, and the case against him would show a man who was in pursuit of nothing more than his own sexual gratification, a man who had no qualms about drugging and sexually assaulting his victims. And in 4 of those cases, he had killed the young men in his apartment. Port had described himself as having a preference for young, small, boyish men, generally called twinks. His preference for penetrating drugged men was clear when examining his computer searches and his site visits, which showed drug rape pornography. He had also video recorded himself having intercourse with unconscious young men. He'd been making men unconscious with drugs and without their consent, for some time so that he could have sex with them without their consent. So drugging them and raping them, and then he'd murdered a few.
Yeah, or he gave them too much GHB or whatever.
Well, yes, I don't think that he intentionally wanted these young men to die necessarily, but it didn't bother him too much, did it?
Sure didn't. It turns out that GHB wasn't the only drug that Port used on his victims. He had also used amyl nitrate, Viagra, Meow Twins, tea, or Tina, and crystal meth. Amyl nitrate, the Meow Twins, tea, or Tina, they're stimulants. So is crystal meth. But the significant thing in this is the GHB. Postmortem toxicology on the four who died showed that each had died from high doses of GHB.
So Port was convicted, and he was sentenced to life in prison with what they call a whole life order, meaning he probably will never get out. The evidence had established that Stephen Port's sexual preference was for penetrating very young men whom he rendered unconscious by giving them drugs. His drug of choice was the GHB, and this drug is highly dangerous since the resultant toxicity can cause dizziness, nausea, and then drowsiness, and then unconsciousness, and eventually a coma, respiratory failure, cardiac arrest, and death. And that's what happened to those four young men.
That's very pleasant.
Isn't that horrible? And one of the particular dangers presented by the drug is that whether presented as a dissolved powder or as a liquid, it is colorless, and it can be readily used to spike a drink without being detected, because the taste can be easily masked by mixing it with strong or sweet flavors. So this is something he'd been doing probably for quite a while. I'm certain that all of his victims had not been found or come forward.
Yeah. His earliest known victim was referred to as Victim A. This is an intelligent and articulate university student who in 2012 was just 19 years old. He made contact with Port on Grindr. And he went to Port's flat. They talked for a bit, and Port seemed pretty friendly. Wasn't any alarm bells going off. Then he was given a glass of wine, and after he drank it, he saw that there's some congealed powder at the bottom of his glass. Now, there's a giveaway. He suspected immediately that he'd been drugged. And he does remember feeling guilty, feeling dizzy and disoriented. Then he lost consciousness. And he was aware that he had been taken into the bedroom, undressed, and raped by the defendant. But he felt mentally and physically unable to resist because of his drug state.
Yeah, when he returned to university, Victim A had told a friend and sought out medical advice because he believed that he had been drugged. He came forward to the police following the report of Stephen Port's arrest. This led to Port's conviction for administering a substance with intent to stupefy or overpower this victim, so as to enable him to engage in sexual activity with him without consent. So this led to a conviction for rape as well. Now, Victim B was 20 when he met Port through another gay website in June 2014. He said that he felt safe and comfortable with Port, who seemed like a really nice guy. He also was given a drink which made him go unconscious, and when he woke up, he described what he called a terrifying effect. He felt as if he had no control over his body, and he was shouting and screaming and calling out for help. He said that Port then took him to the bus station in his drugged state, and there officers from the transport police saw him distressed, incoherent, unsteady on his feet, and vomiting. This victim wasn't able to say for certain if Port had penetrated him in this condition, so there was no rape charge in this case, but there was a charge of administering a substance with intent. So when the jury considered Port's knowledge and intention in relation to his next victim, who was Anthony Walgate, and he was one of the murder victims, of course, they determined that Port's intent was to rape him as well. So Anthony was victim number three.
Yeah, he was 23 years old at the time of his death.
I guess we should call him Victim C, because I had A and B. So Victim C was Anthony Walgate, the third victim, who was age 23 when he was killed by Port.
Yeah, in her victim personal statement, Anthony's mother described him as being clever, funny, and talented. And she said that all he ever wanted was to be a famous fashion designer. And she was sure he would have made it. One of his friends said he was not very good at managing his money, and that's why he resorted to working as a gay escort. But he took precautions. Not enough. He always got the client's address in advance, and he took a photo, which he always posted to friends, so they would know where he was and who he was with. Then through a gay website, Anthony made contact with Port and agreed to meet at Barking Station on the evening of June 17, 2014. He and Port agreed that he would be paid £800 for an overnight session. Since Port had no savings of any kind and no access to £800, he almost certainly had no intention of paying Anthony. Later examination of Anthony Walgate's Oyster card, which is a public transport card, it was established that he had arrived at the station just past 10 that evening, and he was never seen alive again, and his phone was never used again. So it was determined that Anthony was deliberately given an overdose and raped before his body was left outside the apartment building.
So for a variety of reasons explained by the pathologists, it wasn't possible to say exactly when Anthony died, but he was dead when Port calmly went to work the following day. He returned from work about 4 o'clock in the morning on June 19th, and by this time he had redressed Anthony's body, which was likely already stiff with rigor mortis. He dragged the body outside, planted a small bottle of GHB in his pocket, and removed and disposed of Anthony's cell phone. He then called 999 and reported that he had, by chance, come upon the body of a young man collapsed outside of his apartment building. The pathologist reported that the GHB levels in Anthony's body were high enough to cause his death. Later, Port was interviewed. Even when the police told him that they knew that he had met Anthony through an online dating app, Port had continued to deny it. But then he changed his story to say that Anthony had visited him at his flat, but that his death was the result of a self-administered drug overdose. So he said that Anthony had drugged himself and he had moved the body outside because he panicked. He even suggested that he was afraid that they might suspect him of murder. So his earlier lies had led to his conviction for an offense of perverting the course of justice. And he repeated his story to the jury, but they rejected it. Port was convicted of administering a substance to Anthony Walgate and to the murder of Anthony Walgate. So victim D, or number 4, would be Gabriel Covari. He moved into Port's flat on August 23rd of 2014. And there were signs that Port's feelings for Gabriel were not reciprocated. Gabriel sent a text to a friend saying that he had slept on the sofa and didn't want to sleep in the same bed with Port. The last message sent from Gabriel's phone was at 5 o'clock in the morning on the 25th. Port gave drugs to Gabriel, intending to penetrate him when he was unconscious. But the overdose that he administered turned out to be fatal. And the next day, Port changed his phone number and told Ryan Edwards that Gabriel had left unexpectedly. Meanwhile, just by chance, Port's sister called him and had found him in a very upset mood, saying that there was a body of a young man in his apartment. This young man was Gabriel. Gabriel's body remained in the apartment for days, actually, and it wasn't until the morning of August 28th that he was found propped up against the wall of the churchyard. He planted a bottle of GHB in his pocket and disposed of his phone, so the cause of death was ruled a drug overdose with fatal levels of GHB. So on this one, Port was convicted of administering a substance to Gabriel and murdering him. Gabriel had a brother who spoke in court describing the impact that his death had upon the entire family. And I'm very curious about Port's sister. Why didn't she contact the authorities? I'm surprised that she wasn't charged with anything in this.
Yeah, it's her brother.
Well, that just kind of indicates to me that that family has some serious issues.
There's some problems there.
Yeah, yeah.
So the next victim, number 5, or victim E, was Daniel, 23 years old. Daniel and Port had made contact through the gay dating website FitLads. And after a lot of exchanges, they agreed to meet on the afternoon of September 18th. Daniel left work early that day and texted his partner to say that he'd be back late. Now, at 10:30 the next morning, Port deleted his FitLads account. Now, he did this because Daniel was dead, and he was attempting to delete all traces of their contact. And then that night, Port carried Daniel's body to the stone wall where he left it in the same position that he had left the body of Gabriel Cavari. And as he had done with the others, he planted a bottle of GHB in his pocket and stole his cell phone. Now, the cause of Daniel's death was GHB toxicity. Now, this time, Port wrote a suicide note explaining that Daniel had deliberately taken a drug overdose because of the guilt he felt after administering the fatal overdose to Gabriel. Now, under cross-examination, Port's story unraveled, and the truth was exposed that Port had killed both these kids, both these men. For Daniel Whitworth, Port was convicted of administering a substance, rape, and murder. Then victims 6, 7, and 8, or
FGH
and H.
I think we can drop that.
Okay. They were drugged and sexually assaulted. One of them was considerably older than Port's other victims. He was 35, so a little out of character for Port.
So then we come to Jack Taylor, who was the 9th victim and the 4th murder victim. There was evidence that he had accessed gay dating websites before, but he wasn't actually out as gay. There were also strong indications that he didn't voluntarily take any drugs. After an evening of social drinking at a local club, Jack had gone home and gone on the Grindr app. He contacted Port and they agreed to meet at Barking Railway Station, which they did at about 3 a.m. on September 13th. He then went back with Port to his apartment. And Port, of course, was the only living witness to what happened. Just before 7:30 that morning, though, he blocked Jack Taylor's account on Grindr, deleting the messages that had passed between the two of them. So it's believed that by that time, Jack Taylor was already deceased. Later that morning, Port deleted his own Grindr account, too. And he sent a series of messages discouraging his roommate from returning home that morning. He didn't want him to return and find Jack Taylor's dead body.
Well, that wouldn't do.
No, which actually must have remained in the flat all day long. Then later that night, he'd taken Jack's body to the churchyard and positioned his body. He planted a bottle of GHB in his pocket, and he also planted a tourniquet and some medical wipes to make it look like he had self-administered the drug. As he'd done with the others, he disposed of Jack's phone. The toxicologist found GHB at fatal levels. Because Jack had been drinking at the club and because alcohol and GHB can have a cumulative effect, the pathologist certified the cause of death as being a mixed drug and alcohol overdose. So when Port was first asked about Jack Taylor, he said he didn't recognize his name or his photo. He'd not been in contact with him on Grindr, he said. Jack had never been to his flat, and he'd never had intercourse with him. He had no involvement in his death. He even said that Jack wasn't the sort of guy he would go for, since he tended to go for younger guys. You know, and what, Jack was all of 25 years old.
Yeah.
When he testified at the trial, Port changed his story again. He said that Jack was at his flat, and then they had moved into the churchyard to have sex there, and Jack had administered the drugs to himself. And when he left him there, he was alive and well. And the jury was smart enough to dismiss this as more lies. So for Jack's death, Port was convicted of administering a substance and also of murder. So after Jack was murdered, Port raped at least one other young man, and he was convicted of that rape as well. So just a big string of victims.
I guess. So one of the biggest issues in this case, in retrospect, is the lack of interest by police to solve the case and their incompetent investigation of the cases. Families and friends of several of the victims have accused the police of being homophobic and prejudiced, and they suggested that if the victims had been young women, there would have been a much different response.
Yeah, and maybe if they were in a more upper-class neighborhood, that was another thing.
Right. Now, evidence heard at trial showed that there were a series of chances to catch Stephen Port sooner than they did, but police failed to follow through.
Well, it's almost like they were resisting following through. They weren't just not doing it. They were fighting against it, really, because there were people calling and trying to give them information, which they didn't even want to take.
Yeah, well, you know, you're questioning my work here.
Yeah, exactly.
How dare you?
Yeah, probably something like that. In 2019, the Independent Office of Police Conduct, IOPC, had an inquiry where 17 officers were investigated, and they did identify systemic failings within the police. but none of these officers investigated for misconduct faced any disciplinary action. So it's very similar to the way we do things here in the U.S. However, though, 9 officers are required to improve their standards, whatever that means. The findings were brought forward by a coroner who, sitting for a pre-inquest review, promised the grieving relatives a full, fair, and fearless inquiry. 10 officers had been served with misconduct notices over the case, and then an additional 7 with gross misconduct notices. So the 17 ranged in rank from constable to inspector. However, the IOPC findings mean that none of them will face any disciplinary action at all. A spokesperson for the IOPC said that none of the officers involved in the investigations breached professional standards that would justify disciplinary proceedings. They did make recommendations to address some of the systemic failings that were exposed and identified, and the performance of 9 officers fell well below the standard required.
Well, yeah, but nobody's lost their job.
No.
Nobody's really been disciplined.
I know.
Okay.
It's really sad.
So John Pape, who was Gabriel Cavara's former flatmate and the one who had raised concerns with the police investigation into the deaths, said that the IOPC announcement made his blood boil.
Sure.
He told the BBC, "It contrasted with the basic facts of a disturbingly incompetent initial investigation." He said he was not clamoring for individual officers to be harshly punished, but he was concerned about the consequences for the LGBT community and their families of institutionalized incompetence and prejudice within an unaccountable police force.
Absolutely.
That says it.
It does, because Pape and Jack Taylor's sisters, if it weren't for them, who knows? More people probably would have died.
Yeah.
So our sources for this case are the London Evening Standard from November 2016. That's an article by Tristan Kirk. Also, we followed the BBC News from 2012 to 2020, the UK Independent News. Also, there's an excellent documentary from the BBC on Stephen Port. It's titled The Grindr Killer, and that came out in 2016, and it's available on YouTube. Also, we got a lot of information from Pink News Online from March of 2017 and the documents of the Judiciary of England and Wales and the sentencing remarks of Dr. Justice Openshaw from November 2016. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you have any comments, a case suggestion, or a beer recommendation, please send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. Or in our show notes, there's a link to record a voicemail or to contact us through our website. If you'd like to get your future episodes of TCB commercial free, get extra members only episodes each month, and get a free beer glass bottle opener or a set of coasters along with other TCB swag, please consider subscribing as a tie grabber at tiegrabber.com. Also, if you enjoy our show, we'd very much appreciate your leaving a review for us on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen to the podcast. That really goes a long way in getting new listeners and positive exposure for the show. All right, and you have some feedback for us, Dick?
I do. I have a couple voicemails and a couple emails. A fruitful week.
Yes, we've been getting more. I appreciate it a lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
Very good. So the first voicemail is from Monica, and she has a case suggestion.
Hello, Dick and Jill. My name is Monica, and I have a case suggestion for you. I grew up in a little tiny town very close to the Mexican border in South Texas in the Rio Grande Valley. And during my sophomore year of high school, there was a very interesting case that I never really dug into or got to know. It was just all over the news. And it was very terrifying and scary. The Rio Grande Valley is home to South Padre Island, which is a hot spring break spot for college-age students. And me as a high schooler, I worked at the Raymondville McDonald's, and I would see spring breakers come in and out, and they would just flood in between March and April, depending on when the schools let out for spring break. And it was a big hot spot very close to the Mexican border near the Tamaulipas town of Matamoros, Mexico. And as a high schooler, this being all over the news, it was the case of a satanic drug cult out of Mexico who would kidnap and sacrifice and murder and torture. Several people were found in a grave subsequent to the missing and abduction of Mark Kilroy, who I believe was a student at University of Texas in Austin, but I think his family was out of state. I want to say a neighbor, like New Mexico or something like that. But he was a pre-med student. It was all over the news. And I just would love to hear you guys cover this case. It was very interesting and it had a lot of different elements to do with the satanic cults. And there were several bodies found. I'm thinking there were in the upwards of teens or 20 in a shallow grave. And it was like animal remains and just really weird, crazy stuff. But it also had to do with some drug cartel there in Mexico. But it was just very interesting to me. I never really dug into it because at the time as a 15, 16 year old high school student, I only heard what was on the news and several of the details were spared. I didn't research it. I thought maybe I'd let you guys do the work, but it was the case in the Rio Grande Valley, South Hydra Island missing student who went into Mexico to party, collegiate student Mark Kilroy. Anyway, I love you guys. I enjoy listening. I've been binging your podcast through the coronavirus pandemic, and I am so glad I found you guys because I have now become interested in sampling several different kinds of beers from ales to stouts to saisons. It's just been very fun for me to explore and experiment with that as well. But love all you do and can't wait to see if you guys cover this case. Have a great day and keep up the great work.
Thank you, Monica. Thank you so much for calling in with that voicemail. Now that sounds like a very disturbing case.
It does. And the little bit of research I did, it's very disturbing. You've got this satanic cult that does human sacrifices.
Which I always think isn't a real thing, but I guess it rarely is a real thing, right? It has happened.
It has.
But there have been times in recent history where it's been overestimated, I guess.
The cults are good scapegoats. But
this was real.
This is real. So we've got murders, human sacrifices. We've got the drug cartel involved, spring breakers. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
So we'll check it out.
And very different thing for us to venture into. Sounds interesting.
Definitely.
Okay. We have another voicemail from Rosalie.
She has a suggestion and she also has some comments.
All right. Let's hear it.
Hi, Dick and Jill. My name is Rosalie, and I'm a Tie Grabber team member, I guess is the best way to put it. I live out in sunny Southern California. I just wanted to thank you guys for all that you do. I have your podcast on a constant loop, it seems, when I'm not working and sometimes when I am. I also wanted to say what a great job I thought you guys did with the Arthur Shawcross case. I'm also read a lot of Jack Olson, and that was such a complicated case, and you broke it down in a way that was easy to understand, and thankfully you left out some of the more gruesome parts, so that was fantastic. I have a case suggestion and then a couple other comments. I would love to know your guys' thoughts on the case of Fred, aka Kevin Coe. He's often called the South Hill Rapist, and he was victimizing women in the Spokane area in the, I believe it was late 70s, early 80s. But the story of the number of victims and the family dynamics were fascinating. And there's a great book by Jack Olson called Son. You might want to check that story out. It's really interesting. And Dick, this is for you. I just wanted to let you know how much I love your beer reviews. I also love stouts and porters. I lived in Detroit for quite a while, and I'm a huge fan of Founders Brewing, and I especially love the breakfast stout. Okay, now, my last little thing is sometimes things are, it just feels like such a small world. So when the Susan and Felix Polk case was going on, I was working at a domestic violence agency in that area, actually. And during her trial, my agency got very involved. And it was fascinating because the staff was wildly split between wanting to stand behind and support a battered woman, but also a lot of us, including myself, really doubted her victim title. So I thought you handled that case very well as well. Actually, I think you handle all the cases well, but I just wanted to leave that. I know how much Jill loves voicemails, so thank you both for all you do. I really appreciate it, and I will be a Tie Grabber member for as long as you're on the air. Thanks for all you do, guys. Hope you're well.
Thanks so much, Rosalie. We do love voicemails, and we do appreciate it.
Yeah, that I read that book years ago, and I was looking in my bookcase to see if I still had it, but I don't.
What book?
Sun.
Okay.
But it was fascinating. And the other interesting thing was that when Rosalie was talking about the family dynamics, after his conviction, his mother tried to hire a hitman to kill the judge and the prosecuting attorney, something like that.
It was just, wow.
Yeah, it's all screwy stuff.
Yeah, but that's fascinating stuff. I love a case with that kind of stuff going on.
Well, we'll review it. I think that'd be a good one to do sometime.
Okay.
So,
yeah, Susan Polk case was fascinating.
Yeah, that was a good case, too.
So it's nice to hear a little feedback on that as well.
See?
Yep. And Founders Beer, yes.
Breakfast Stout.
Sign us up. Yep. Okay. So a couple emails.
Two emails. One from Mary. She has a case suggestion. And she says, I love your show. I have a show idea. When I attended high school in Elk Grove Village, Illinois, our gym teacher at the time was arrested for killing her husband.
That has to be something, right? To be in high school and have something like that happen?
Warp you a little bit, huh?
Crazy.
Her name is Nola Jean Weaver. Interesting case. You might want to take a look. Thanks for being here every week. I look forward to hearing you both.
Well, thank you, Mary, and thanks for listening every week.
Absolutely. So, yeah, she killed her husband. Didn't get much jail time for it. I think she ended up serving only a few years.
So was this some kind of abused spouse situation?
Well, I was trying to see if that was one of her things, but it wasn't. She basically shot him while he was asleep.
Wow.
And I can't remember if there was a trial.
Well, we'll look into it.
There was a trial, obviously.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I think there was a conviction, and then it was overturned. Anyway, she ended up not serving that much time. And she's a real sweetheart because she was having an affair with her boss at the school. Okay. She's a phys ed teacher. And she's also banging her brother-in-law, her sister's husband.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay,
so Nola Jean got around.
Well, you know, at least on a positive note, it breaks down that whole cliche of female gym teachers being lesbians. Because she was apparently interested in having sex with men.
Yes, that's
Although
true.
Although she sounds like an absolute horror of a human. But yeah, let's look into that one.
I'm writing it down.
Okay. So one more case suggestion email from Barbara. And Barbara writes, I'm enjoying my Tie Grabber subscription. Thank you. My case suggestion, 41-year-old Mizek Damas, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, killed his wife, Gerline, and his 5 children, ages 1 to 9, in a townhome complex off of Pine Ridge Road in Naples, Florida, in 2009. My close friend, Gail, lived a few doors away in a different building, but too close for comfort. This is a very sad story of refugee immigrants from the Haitian earthquake a decade or so ago. Gerline worked full-time and cared for her 5 children, a woman dedicated to providing a better life for her kids. Not much known about Mesic. I have had a glimpse into the Haitian culture with my community being a haven for immigrants and refugees for decades. I do know that the Haitian women seem to have easily assimilated into the culture of the average working mom in the country, but the men have had a greater problem with reestablishing themselves outside of the environment they were born into and grew up in. Just an observation. The location of the crime borders the Naples, Florida city limits, both a 5-minute drive to reach from where I live. I don't feel this crime has received the attention it deserves. The crime itself is horrific enough. But then there are so many variables. Taking a truly deep dive might not be practical, but I thought if anyone could tell the story in a way that would honor Gerline and her children, it is the two of you. Aw, that's so nice. Thank you. Thanks for reading my email, and thank you again for the sensitivity and honesty that resonates from your podcast. XXXOOO Barbara. Well, thanks, Barbara. You're really very sweet, and it does sound like a fascinating case. It sounds like a lot in the backgrounds of these people, a lot in sociology of it. It could be an interesting thing to find out more about, I think.
Yeah, which he's writing about in terms of the men having a tougher time assimilating into a different culture. I think that's what, at least some factor in this case. I don't believe that the husband had a job, or if he did, it was kind of a menial one, and he had excellent training.
Huh.
So I'll check in, see if we got some more sources to look at.
Well, yeah, and there has to be more information about that. There has to be a reason for that.
Right.
And I can think of some off the top of my head, but without knowing what's really a fact, I'm not going to guess.
No speculation.
No speculating today, but definitely something worth looking into.
You bet.
And I apologize for any mispronunciations. If you've listened to the show at all, you know that's a thing with me.
On occasion.
Not too bad.
You do pretty well.
Not too bad, but probably at least once every other episode, there's some kind of mispronunciation, I would say.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, guys.
Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. We definitely appreciate that. We appreciate your feedback. So if you have any ideas about a case, please don't be shy. Don't hesitate.
Yeah, we'd love to hear it. Love to hear from you.
Absolutely. And we'll see you next time at the quiet end.
We'll save a seat for you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.